Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos. And by Christogenos, we mean the seed of Jesus Christ, okay? The holy seed created by Yahweh, and that's what we're talking about here today in chapter 2, the holy seed created by Yahweh in the Garden of Eden. And we, Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Israelite, Caucasians, are the actual literal descendants of that seed through Adam and Eve. And, of course, we're talking about, in these critical chapters here, chapters 2 and 3, the circumstances that resulted in the fall of Adam and Eve. Okay, Bill says the talk show cut him off, so we'll give him a chance to call in again. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to make this announcement. We have been receiving, we've been getting slimed, as it were. Somebody is trying to disrupt our, you know, our signal. And it's been happening. Bill received the treatment last Sunday that I've been getting. Somebody's trying to disrupt our email voice and listening capability. And somebody's been sending me monkey noises that are very distracting. I've been trying very hard to ignore that kind of stuff. But, you know, we are proceeding, and I'm sure there's other kinds of electronic interference that people are trying to, you know, impose upon us. But we are doing a bang-up job of trying to defend ourselves electronically. So, and Bill's more computer savvy than I am. And maybe we'll find out who the offender is. Are you there, Bill?
Hello, Eli. Praise
Hello.
Yahweh.
Yeah, praise Yahweh. Now, I'm going to click on one of Yahweh's chosen as well. If you want to join us in the discussion, please do so, okay? All right. But I turned that telephone on. If you're there, you can go ahead and join us. Feel free.
I just want to listen.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So I'll just go ahead and mute you then, okay? Because a lot of times there's phone interference. Okay, here we go. All right, so let me just briefly, for those who are tuning in for the first time, Christogenos is going to be an ongoing series. We're starting out with the two seed line message, but it's an ongoing series about the seed of Adam. That's what we're going to be discussing. And, of course, Paul refers to Jesus Christ as the second Adam. And in the genealogy of, I believe it's Luke chapter 3, we have the genealogy of Yahshua Messiah all the way from Yahweh God through Adam, through all the intermediary patriarchs. And we are the literal relatives slash descendants of that seed. And we're going to chronicle the history of that seed in the series of programs here. And, of course, that means we're going to do intensive study of the Bible and the seed lines, okay? So this is why we're getting started with the seed line message to begin with. And last, we've only had two programs so far. And the last one had to do, I think we actually went all the way up to Genesis 2:10, but I want to go back to Genesis 2:8. And before we get started, Bill, do you have any comments, any kind of summary of the first two shows that you want to do?
One listener had written me, and he's a longtime identity adherent and a very bright man, and he's been writing me for some time now, and he made a succinct description of Genesis chapters 1 and 2.
Okay.
That I tried to say, but I couldn't say so in so few words.
Yes.
And that is that Genesis 1 is a generic plural creation of Adam kind, and Genesis 2 begins the allegorical account of the fall of Adam through
mm-hmm.
of the fall of the Adamic race through
right.
the patriarch Adam.
Right, right.
And I more or less tried to say that last week, but he just put it so succinctly that I wanted to repeat it.
Okay, please.
Well, that's it.
Oh, that's it? Oh, okay.
It's short.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. Okay. Very succinct indeed.
It's short and sweet, and it probably took me 30 minutes
right.
to get that out last
Well,
week.
One proviso is that only the race of Adam fell. None of the other races fell.
Well, absolutely. But yeah. The other races aren't even a
they're not part
subject of the Bible.
Yeah,
so.
Except peripherally as our people encounter them, yes. Yes.
Right. The first mention in the Bible of other races specifically is probably Genesis 15, except for the Rephaim and the events of Genesis
mm-hmm.
6 and the race of Cain.
Right.
We have Genesis 15, 19 through 21, and that mentions several races that have no part in the Bible before that mention.
Okay, yeah. Well, of course, I want to go back to Genesis 1, chapter 1, leading up to the creation of Adam, where Adam is first used in Genesis 1:26. The beast of the field and the beast of the earth, these are references to what I call featherless bipeds, and that word che, which is often translated as beast, also refers to two-legged beings, not just four-legged animals, and that translation of che as simply beast is very misleading, because that word beast in many places in the Bible describes people with two hands, two feet, vocal cords, and the ability to pray to God even, okay? And the ability to wear sackcloth, which we don't normally put sackcloth on our animals. So clearly, Genesis chapter 2, we cannot conceive of Genesis chapter 2 without all of the races being present here on the earth already. And that Genesis chapter 2, Yahweh is singling out the Adamic race, the white race, exclusively, because the very word Adam means to show blood in the face, which cannot mean any other race but the white race, okay? Is that a suitable introduction for to continue?
Well, absolutely. And the word's translated beast of the field, nefesh che is the phrase.
Yes.
And that's much more appropriately translated living creatures.
Okay, yes, which is a very broad term. And it certainly includes the two-legged beasts and not just four-legged beasts, okay? And a thorough word study done on those two, nefesh che or che nefesh, whatever order you put those in, means, yes, living creature that means more than just four-legged beasts. It has a very wide range of connotations, and we'll find that's true of a lot of the words that have been translated very specifically by the King James translators. And sometimes you have to scratch your head and wonder why they translated a certain word in a certain way. But we spent a lot of time discussing Genesis 2:7 because Yahweh Elohim himself personally breathed the breath of life into Adam in Genesis 2:7, and no other type of creature, no other seed line, no other living creature had this done to him. This is Yahweh personally breathing the breath of life, that is the Holy Spirit, into Adam himself. And that's how I understand Genesis 2:7, okay? And unless you have any comments on 2:7, I'll continue reading from 2:8, and we'll continue our study.
Well, right, except that I see Genesis 2:7 and that event as that, the particular patriarch Adam, what happens to him
yes.
is also representative of the whole race of Adam.
Yes, okay.
We all contain that living spirit.
Right, right. And even, let's say, even if there were other white people around, because the question is always, you know, well, did Adam and Eve have other children besides Cain and Abel? And the other historical records say, yes, they did. And Dr. Wesley Swift, when we get into Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve sinned, he believes that once Eve's womb was polluted by non-Adamic seed, by non-Adamic sperm, to be very specific, he said that she had to have seven gestations before her womb could be cleansed in order to bear a true Adamic children again, okay? And so, in other words, Adam and Eve would have had other children that simply aren't mentioned in the Bible, okay? Because it's a very, very brief account, and we can't make assumptions either way. Okay, Pastor Dan says your sound is a little low. Maybe you can get closer to your, I don't know if you got a cordless or a headset or a regular phone.
Maybe that's better.
Oh, there you go. Much better. Much better.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
All of the patriarchs had other children, and only, and it reads all throughout Genesis, so-and-so had such-and-such as his first son, as a son, and then he had other sons and daughters. He lived so many X number of years and had sons and daughters.
Yes, yes.
That statement is common in Scripture. Only the eldest male line is followed down to Noah.
Right.
But they
right.
all had many other sons and daughters.
Okay, yes.
However, right. I think that Wesley Swift, he got caught up with this telegony, and if you want, I can prepare for that, and we could have a whole night's discussion about telegony. Telegony, as far as I'm concerned, is the theory, is a fraudulent theory.
Okay.
And the seven gestations, to me, is an addition to Scripture.
Yes.
It's a supposition being made. I have a lot of respect for Wesley Swift,
mm-hmm.
but that there are times where he's wrong, and we're all wrong, and there are times where he stretched things and fell into some New Age traps, I believe, and this is one of them.
Dr. Wesley Swift was a New Ager?
Well, I'm saying that he was affected by some New Age thoughts.
Could certainly have been, yes.
And we're all susceptible to
yeah.
that, but
yeah, and,
nobody's right all the time.
Right.
That's the
yeah.
way it is. And I believe that he's wrong on the telegony thing, and he's wrong on the seven gestations.
Okay. Well, I'm pretty much a believer in a telegony. I pronounce it telegony. I haven't actually looked it up in the dictionary to see how it's actually pronounced. But I've done animal studies, and my impression is that cow breeders, horse breeders, and dog breeders all believe in it. And that it's mainstream science, which is guided by the Jews.
Well,
I
understand that mainstream science and mainstream medicine can always be,
yes.
you know, the Jewish bogeyman, and they do have a lot of control over the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not
oh,
going to
yeah.
dispute that. But the Jewish bogeyman is always thrown as a cloak by identity people over uh-huh. over these vocations.
Right, right.
The
yeah.
the understanding of DNA. And the fact that if you know what an oocyte is, O-O-C-Y-T-E.
Okay.
And oocyte is the organism from which a female ova
mm-hmm.
is extracted.
Okay.
And that's done through a degenerative process each month, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And every female baby is already born.
Mm-hmm.
With all of those oocytes that are future ova
right.
in place.
Exactly. Exactly.
And all the DNA of that female's possible offspring is already coded in all of those hundreds of thousands of oocytes
mm-hmm.
in her womb.
Right. Right.
And there is no known mechanism that anything could get in there and rewrite all that DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no known mechanism. And that's the only way telegony could work, is to rewrite all that DNA.
Uh-huh.
It has nothing to do with the blood. It has nothing to do with anything else but a particle breaking off of that oocyte and falling down a fallopian tube into uh-huh. that young woman's womb, and all her DNA is there from her parents at birth.
Right, right. Yeah, and that certainly covers the female side of it, and mostly. And for those people who are unaware, when a woman runs out of those, that's when, what's the term, they have hot flashes and stuff? they run out
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that's
run,
part of the menopause.
Menopause, there you go. It should
right.
be heropause, not men. It refers to menses, which is, of course, the period. And so the period stops and the eggs run out. That's basically what it means, yeah.
Well, I have challenged people in the past who were telegony advocates to show me the mechanism by which genetic material from a father can pass through the blood of a woman into those oocytes and rewrite
mm-hmm.
all of that genetic material,
right.
all of that DNA in hundreds of thousands of oocytes.
Yeah, well, I've done a lot of study on this, and that's not how it works. it doesn't affect the oocytes in where they're located, but it does affect the womb. Okay, that's how I understand it. So let's save that for when it's appropriate, because you know I can compare my research with yours, and that should be a really good subject. Yeah. Okay, so here let's continue now with Genesis chapter 2 verse 8. And Yahweh Elohim planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made Yahweh Elohim to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I think we briefly touched on Genesis 2:9 last time, but I think it bears repeating here that we're talking here about literal trees and figurative trees as well. Okay, so in phrase one, and out of the ground made Yahweh Elohim to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. Now, that can be literal trees, no doubt about it. But the tree of life and also the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that is especially tree of knowledge of good and evil, that can't be a reference to a literal tree, because plants and trees do not have moral capacity. They just grow. And we either leave them alone or we eat them, but they don't have moral decision-making powers. And so knowledge of good and evil cannot possibly be applied to a literal tree. How do you feel?
Well, I have a few things to say about this.
Okay.
First, the garden was already planted when Adam was put into it.
Right.
Now, going back to the metaphor and what I said in my opening remarks about Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, that makes sense in the sense that Genesis 1 is a plural creation of Adam kind,
right.
and Genesis 2 is the patriarch Adam and the story of the fall of our race through him.
Yes, yes. Exactly.
Now,
okay.
this the garden, what I'm saying is that the garden may be representative of the race itself.
Yes, okay.
Now, that's just one possibility.
Right.
The garden already exists, and it's in a part of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
The garden itself is not Eden. And
right.
I explained that Eden is the Akkadian word for the steppe.
Yes.
And that's probably what Eden means here.
Mm-hmm.
And that could describe what we consider today to be northern India, or the land north of Afghanistan, or
mm-hmm.
the Tibetan Plateau, or any of the other theories. Eden, or the steppe, runs through that region.
Yes.
And that's a plausible place for this Garden of Eden, but I'm not supporting that theory entirely. I'm just throwing
yes.
that out there as one possible scenario out of several.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Now,
yeah, go ahead.
A correlating metaphor to people and trees is found in Ezekiel 31:3-4, where the Assyrian nation is described as a cedar in Lebanon.
Yes.
And it's compared to the other trees of the field. All right, so,
mm-hmm.
and that's a metaphor for the smaller nations that are subject to Assyria at the time. So gardens and trees and people, this is symbolic throughout the Bible. It's not just here.
Right, right.
The
right.
trees of the garden are good for food. But the other trees, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, aren't the trees of the garden. They're
right.
trees in the midst of the garden.
Right. And also, this term midst in the midst of the garden, when Jay Faber was on my show a few Sundays ago, that he said that phrase can also be translated throughout.
Well, right.
Mm-hmm.
It insinuates that these trees are portable or mobile trees.
Right.
And that they've introduced themselves into the garden.
Yeah.
And that phrase surely insinuates that.
Right.
And the tree of life is mentioned three times in the Revelation.
Okay.
Once in chapter 2 in verse 7 and twice in chapter 22.
Yes.
The tree of life is symbolic of something that's righteous, and it's something to which righteous people have access.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally given that Yahshua Christ is the tree of life.
Yes.
Okay? So therefore, it's wholly evident that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which here is set in opposition to the tree of life,
mm-hmm.
has to be the adversary.
Right.
It has to be Satan, the fallen angels, however you want.
Yeah, or I simply refer to it as the tree of race mixing.
Well, you know, they've already done all that. And we discussed that.
Yeah, but the Adam and the Eve have not yet done it, at least not at this point in the Bible. Yeah.
Right, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they're the fallen race that they knew what was good.
Right.
And
now
they've done evil.
So if we take this figuratively, metaphorically here, what this could be telling us is that Yahweh Elohim is pointing out to Adam, you see these race mixed people here? they're the sons of Satan or Azazel or Lucifer or whatever name you want to put on it, fallen angels, and they're walking around, visible to Adam.
Okay? And as we discussed last week, this is something that's all throughout the New Testament, and it's hard to deny. And
right.
I don't know how these no Satan people.
Yeah. Well, see,
have the gumption to deny.
Yeah. Now the interesting thing about. For most people reading Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and 4, we're going to cover chapter 4, too, is they fail to connect the rest of the Bible with these opening chapters, okay? And what you have to do is any metaphor that's given in these first four chapters, you will find very often these metaphors used throughout Scripture, if not numerous times, at least a few times, okay? And so you cannot take these first four chapters all by themselves and say, well, this is what it must mean. It must mean this or that. You have to compare it to the other usages of the words and the metaphors. And then, as you just pointed out, Ezekiel 34, was it? Where
Ezekiel 31,
where the nation of Assyria is referred to as a cedar tree because it was a huge nation, okay? And so what we're talking about here is trees. These are family trees. Figurative trees, not literal trees. Of course, the word can be used literally, but you have to look at the context. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, and without comparing and referring to the context, certainly, there's no such thing as a tree that knows good and evil. Okay? There's no literal tree that knows good and evil, plain and simple. Okay? So we are, in fact, in my opinion, you know, talking about race mixing here, the tree of knowledge and good and evil. And what was your characterization of it? You had a different way of putting it.
Well, yeah, these fallen angels, they knew what was good.
Okay, right.
And after they were cast out here, they performed that which was evil.
Yeah,
they knew good and they knew evil.
Yeah,
and
evil people do know what good is. They just choose not to do it. Yeah. It's not like they don't know. It's not like they're ignorant. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, very good. All right, let's continue here. Verse 10. Okay, I didn't have time to look up the actual possible locations of the Garden of Eden. We discussed that on a separate show. That was actually the one with Jay Faber where we discussed the Pamir Plateau and we discussed Asia Minor. Having very similar circumstances in terms of four rivers. So I'm just going to read through these, and if you have something, you know, to add to these, please do so, okay? Verse 10, and a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that is it which compasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good, there is bdellium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is the Gihon. The same is it that compasses the whole land of Ethiopia. Now here we want to, I think we briefly talked about the two Ethiopias in Scripture. And here I think we want to say that this is only the eastern Ethiopia, the Kush of the East, which would include or at least approach India, correct?
Well, it could.
Okay.
Pison comes from a Hebrew word at Strong's number 6376, and it signifies simply water poured forth,
okay.
Overflowing, dispersive. Havilah, it could mean, in Jesenius's lexicon, it means abounding in gold or pearls or precious stones. And it's mentioned in connection with countries producing gold.
Mm-hmm.
And as being on the Persian Gulf, and it must be in the neighborhood of India.
Okay.
and their conclusions drawn from the way the word is used elsewhere.
Right.
Kishon properly simply means a river.
Okay.
From the etymological root meaning to gush forth. It's
okay.
Strong's number 1521. Now, the whole land of Cush is the Hebrew translated Ethiopia here.
Mm-hmm.
And the land, the eastern land of Cush, the Greeks called it in Herodotus on several occasions the Ethiopia of the East.
Okay.
And before Herodotus, 150 years before Herodotus, we have Hesiod, the poet, who wrote that Memnon, king of the Ethiopians of the East, built Susa, the capital of Persia.
Mm-hmm.
And Memnon was also a famous Ethiopian or Cushite,
okay,
who was a warrior that fought in the Trojan War, that came to the assistance of the Trojans.
Agamemnon, yes. Mm-hmm.
No. This
no?
is just Memnon.
Okay.
His name is Memnon the Ethiopian.
Okay, any relationship?
Agamemnon is actually a different word.
Oh, okay.
And Agamemnon is an adversary of Troy.
Ah, interesting. Okay. All right.
There's a lot. If you look at all the earliest Greek myths,
mm-hmm,
are connected to the East, to Mesopotamia,
right,
to Palestine. The Greeks were definitely not familiar with these things, and it had to be because that was their origin. And another instance is Heracles saves Andromeda from the sea monster, and Josephus and other Greek writers say that happened at Joppa.
Okay.
And Josephus says that you could still see the chains that Heracles broke.
Wow.
In his time, and that's in Antiquities.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great connection between the earliest Greek mythology and the East, and they were
right,
very familiar with the East. They were familiar with Akkadian. They spoke. They knew to speak Assyrian, which is the Akkadian language, at the time that was the lingua franca,
mm-hmm,
which is before the rise of the Persian Empire, when Aramaic became the lingua franca.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
So the Greeks are very well versed, and they have two Ethiopias.
Right.
And one of them is the Ethiopia of the East, and that is what historians and archaeologists call the first Babylonian Empire.
Uh-huh.
It was
right,
founded by Cush,
mm-hmm,
and that was called Cush. And okay, that's evident in the story of Moses, who went to the land of Cush for a wife.
Yes.
And we find that that his wife was a Midianite from Arabia,
sure,
later on in the same chapters of Exodus.
Yeah. At the time, it was a purely white nation, and it wasn't Arabian, as
right,
we would call it today. Yes.
Right. Arab simply means mixed.
Exactly.
And there were non-white tribes there, obviously, but Midian was a white tribe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The,
all right.
The Moses being in the land of Cush would have been in the 15th century B.C. or in the late 16th century B.C.,
mm-hmm,
being about 1500 B.C., and then
right,
the first Babylonian Empire was still a great empire at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it extended from Arabia all the way to the Indus River in India.
Right. Well,
so for a river to encompass the whole land of Cush, it may just mean the original. I don't think it means the entire empire, because it's a pretty large one. I think it probably means that original district of Cush,
yes,
which was in Mesopotamia, and it may describe the present-day Euphrates or the present-day Tigris rivers.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, certainly most historians conceive of it that way. It's just that it's very important for people to understand that there is an Eastern Ethiopia, because a lot of anti-identity folk want to argue that this is the black territory, the territory of black people, and that when Moses found an Ethiopian woman, he found a Negress. That's what they like to argue anyway, you know.
Well, right, and that's just crazy, because
yeah,
the Greeks, it's all in the Greek writings. As early as Herodotus, as early as Hesiod, there was an Ethiopia of the East, and it describes an empire that existed in Mesopotamia.
Yes.
And further east than that, in Persia. And there was also an Ethiopia below Egypt in Greek writings.
Right.
And it's very clear to me, I mean, I don't know if I could actually point to a reference, but it's very clear to me from my overall knowledge of history that it's the Kushites who settled the Horn of Africa and called that, after their own name, Kush.
Right.
And that became a second land of Kush.
Exactly, exactly.
And the Hebrews have two Kushes, and the Greeks have two Ethiopias.
Yeah. Right,
and
right.
It's a very short journey by sea from Babylonia,
mm-hmm.
which was the seat of the first Kushite Empire, to the Horn of Africa and the land of Kush that became known as the Ethiopia we know today.
Right, right. Okay, all right, very good. All right, so let's continue with verse 14. And the name of the third river is Hiddekel, that is, which goes toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates. Any comments on these two names of rivers?
Well, Hiddekel is the modern Euphrates, or it's the Tigris that's east of Assyria. And the
okay.
Euphrates would be on the western bank of what we know later as the historic part of Assyria.
Right.
And they could be the Tigris and the Euphrates of today.
Okay.
I'm not going to dispute that. Hiddekel is not a Hebrew name. It's a name of foreign origin, according to Strong's. It's 2313
mm-hmm.
in the coordinates. And it's assumed to be the Tigris River by many scholars.
Right.
But the assumption does not explain why the location is given east of Assyria when it was well known that Assyria extended eastward well beyond the Tigris.
But, right.
And that's a comment actually written by a friend of mine that's drawing this from commentaries. However, Assyria proper was between
yes.
the Tigris and the Euphrates. The
right.
empire extended east of the Tigris, but that's not Assyria proper.
Right. Okay.
That's not the proper land of Asher.
Right. Well, taking this translation as most people receive it, as having written by Moses, okay, Moses might have conceived of Assyria as being bordered on the east by the Tigris and on the west by the Euphrates, and that's why it's put in this way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. He would have, the Assyrian Empire actually came a little after the time of Moses.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so we have to try to conceive of this as being written through the eyes of Moses, through his experience. And, certainly a well-traveled man, no doubt about it, okay? But, unlike nations today, which have clearly defined borders, for example, I can go to the south side of Chicago at Avenue A and walk a little bit east of there and have one foot in Indiana and the other foot in Illinois, okay? But we don't have, we have those kind of clearly defined borders. And even that is it's a line, it's an imaginary line. However, it's, depending on the country you're in, it can be very strictly enforced or not strictly enforced. And we didn't have those kind of boundaries in the ancient, in the ancient world, did we?
Not the way we see them today. No, lines weren't delineated quite as sharply.
Yes, yes.
Often the only lines that existed at all were walls that were purposely built by kings.
Yes, yes.
And rivers and seas.
Right, right. The borders.
Moses, growing up as a prince in Pharaoh's house, probably would have had a good tutelage in language and in geography.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And the borders of nations varied as, certain areas were conquered and brought into a particular kingdom, taken away from another kingdom. Those borders were very vague, somewhere between one town and the next, usually.
Well, right. That's true in the ancient world, and that's how Arabia could be called Kush.
Yes.
But it's also true in the modern world. I mean, my Fink ancestors are from the Rhineland in Germany. But on their birth certificates, it says Prussia because at the time that some of them were born, it was the Rhineland belonged to Prussia.
Yes. Yeah.
And that threw us off when certain members of my family were researching our genealogy.
Yes, yes. Right, right. You're a Prussian?
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah, so let's keep this in mind. A lot of these statements are not necessarily vague, but the concepts, we can't impose modern concepts of words onto, you know, this ancient language, because
that's true not only of the Old Testament but of the entire Bible.
Right, that's true. Exactly. And that's why we need to maintain a historical perspective throughout, and never impose our modern ideas upon the authors who wrote the Bible.
Absolutely. Whenever it's possible, we have to look at contemporary literature, and we're going to see that when we cover Genesis chapter 3.
Yes. Okay. All right. So verse 15, Genesis 2, ladies and gentlemen, and Yahweh Elohim took the man, Adam is his name, and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it up and to keep it. Okay, so here it's telling us that Adam came from outside of the garden and was put into the garden. This is a pretty much overlooked verse, that this is what it says. Put him into the garden, because everybody seems to assume that he was formed in the garden and not outside the garden. But here it's telling us he came from outside the garden. Any comments on this verse?
Well, it's pretty obvious that he wasn't created in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it may well be representative of the garden. It may be a representative of a double entendre. It might represent both the fruits of the earth by which man is nourished and the garden of our race.
Yes.
I would stay by that.
Yeah.
I don't have much else to add to that. Adam may be the patriarch guarding over the race,
and it
may be representative of that, as well as the fact that Adam is, that our race is the beginning of historical agriculture here on this planet.
Right, exactly. And that's what this verse is telling us, to dress it and keep it. Let's presume it's a literal garden of plants, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, to dress it and to keep it, which talks about agriculture, which was not standard practice before the Adamites, under Adam, took over. What I would say, we had limited agriculture in the sense that whatever nation you could say existed at the time, they were simply hunter-gatherers, but there were certain areas that were very fertile, where you could simply go and pluck your food without having to till the ground, and you could have enough food in your vicinity to actually have large towns and perhaps even cities, okay, small cities. But without full-blown agriculture, tilling the earth and reaping huge harvests, there really can be nothing like nations that we see today and gigantic cities that we see today. You have to have plentiful food, and you have to have more than a hunter-gatherer society to sustain that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and this is what the Adamites, only the Adamites have done, folks. Only the Adamites have done. Okay, verse 16. And Yahweh Elohim commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. Now, of course, the non-seedliners want to take this word eat very, very literally and very specifically only to the act of eating food. However, I don't have the Hebrew. Wait a minute. Let me quickly turn to my concordance. The Hebrew is akal, A-K-A-L, and it does mean to eat literally or figuratively, okay? So there are times, and we can cite examples where the word eat is used in later portions of the Old Testament, the word akal, for sexual intercourse, and for non-food eating, okay, in figurative senses. Are you?
Well, it's in Proverbs 30:20.
Okay.
Such is the way of an adulterous woman. She eateth and wipeth her mouth and saith, I have done no wickedness.
Mm-hmm.
And that eating is absolutely a sexual connotation.
Right. It's fornication. Yeah.
Proverbs 9:17, the word akal does not exist in the verse. However, it's certainly inferred, where it says, stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually told in a proverb about silly women.
Okay.
And that's definitely a reference, has a sexual connotation.
Yes, yes. So, again, we have to, you know, look at all the possibilities. And part of studying the scriptures requires a certain knowledge of the Hebrew idioms, okay, and which the idioms are, you know, often double meanings. If you don't know the idioms, then you cannot understand the verse, okay? A good example would be Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt, okay? And a lot of people will take that literally, but even today in the Aramaic world, that still exists as a figure of speech, meaning that you were so terrified that you simply froze in your place. So that's the idiomatic meaning of that, you know, turned into a pillar of salt. We cannot take it literally in every case. We have to think about what's being said here and, you know, look at alternatives, you know, especially if there are known alternatives in Hebrew idioms, correct?
Absolutely. And we'll, I can't wait to get to Genesis 3 and talk about some of the idioms there.
Yes, right.
Yes, one must understand the idioms to understand the language.
Yes, yes.
Because if I tell you you have a hole in your head, and that gets translated into Japanese, and somebody might take that literally and
yeah, and call a doctor.
Cause all kinds of confusion.
Yes, like, right.
And that's true of any language.
Give a person a heart attack.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. We have to understand these idioms. Yes.
Now, if I'm not saying that this is not a literal garden, I'm saying that this is a double entendre, which means a saying that has two meanings at the same time, and both of them are true.
Yes.
And if the garden represents the race of Adam, as he created the male and female, and the personal Adam is the man Adam is the patriarch of that race. However, every tree of the garden would be good for food.
Yes. Yeah. Depending on who's
that's
eating
what
it.
The garden
yes.
Represents.
Yeah. It depends
except,
on who's eating it too. Yes.
Right. Except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is that other race in the midst of the garden.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Excellent.
And that goes with the parable of the wheat and the tares, because the enemy that sowed the tares was the devil, and that was done right at the beginning.
That's right. That's exactly what Genesis 3:15 is all about. And, yeah, we cannot discuss that verse without discussing the parable of the wheat and tares. We'll do that probably in great detail. Okay?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, verse 17. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which I interpret as meaning race mixing, you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Okay, so now a lot of people say there was no law existing before Moses was given the law on Mount Sinai. But isn't Yahweh here telling Adam, you don't, if you do this, you will die, so you better not do it.
Right. This evidence in the Exodus itself, that there is law prior to the giving of the law on Mount Sinai.
Right.
That there is a code of ethics, and it may not have been a written code of ethics, but there were laws that our race followed. That's
yes.
Very clear from the Exodus account, from Moses' discourse with Jethro, that there were laws and there were things to be done and rituals and sacrifices, Cain and Abel sacrificed, and they had to have some sort of law to sacrifice by.
Right.
Why would they sacrifice without some sort of demand for rituals?
Exactly, exactly.
Even at that early time.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and it wasn't just ritual. Yahweh's laws always have, even if we remember the ritual, we may forget what it was all about.
Well, right, but the proper reason for any ritual is to fulfill the requirement of a god, and in the sacrifice, that is to fulfill a recompense for sin.
Right, right. So let's keep this verse, Genesis 2:17, in mind when we get to the point where Eve is deceived by Nahash, because he contradicts this statement, okay? And he gets Eve to believe him. Okay, verse 18. And Yahweh Elohim said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet. Okay? What's going on with this word helpmeet? What does that mean?
Well, a helpmeet is just what it says. It's an assistant. It's somebody to assist man in his endeavors.
Yes, okay. Yeah, also... in doing the word studies on this chapter, I forget the exact Hebrew words, and I don't have my concordance turned to the correct page, but it certainly means someone to help Adam. In figurative language, it can also mean shield bearer. So that someone who is not just an assistant, but a very important, a very important assistant. Okay.
This helpmate is actually a phrase from two Hebrew words, and the first one is Ezer, and it means it's Strong's number 5828, and
okay.
It means an aid or a help.
Yes.
A helper, an aider.
Yes.
And the other word, I don't know if I want to try to. It's Kenegdow or
right.
Or something
Kenegdow,
like that.
Right.
Kenegdow. And it's number 5048, or. It's from a suffix and 5040 or a neged, and
yes.
It means a counterpart.
Right.
So it's a helping counterpart.
Right. Right.
It's,
okay.
It's basically what helpmate means.
Yes, and so yeah, in the strongest sense of mate, someone that you can really count on. In other words, a counterpart.
Oh, right, and if any man today could find a wife like that, we'd be awfully fortunate.
Right. Exactly.
Now they just want to help you out of your credit card.
A good woman is hard to find, right?
Right.
That's quite absolutely. A phrase. Okay, verse 19. And out of the ground, Yahweh Elohim formed every beast of the field. There's those beasts of the field again. And every fowl of the air, and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. So what we're having being told here is that Adam is the first biologist, botanist. He's the first one to start naming animals and categorizing them, correct?
Well, yes, this definitely infers that. And I see this as indicative of that. However, I really see these verses as a parable that it's not an exactly historic account, but it's rather a parable which is meant to demonstrate the importance of our mating only with those of our own kind.
Okay.
And that all these other beasts of the earth, while Adam named them, and this includes the non-Adamic races, this has to include bipeds.
Yes.
I don't think Adam was thinking about mating with quadrupeds or birds.
Sure, certainly not. Yes.
And it shows how they are not potential mates.
Yes.
That
okay.
Under any circumstances, they're unsuitable to mate with.
Right. Well, Genesis chapter 1 has the expression after its kind at least 6 or 7 times, stressing
yes.
That all these creatures are supposed to reproduce only after their own kind and not to engage in hybridization.
Right. And year in and year out, I have blue jays and cardinals in my yard, but I never have a blue cardinal.
That's right. Although a blue jay may get traded to the Cardinals every so often. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so in verse 19, we can infer that what we're talking about is species categorization along the lines of Genesis chapter 1, which sees separate species as set apart from one another and to breed apart from one another. And, there's nothing ever in Scripture that suggests otherwise.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Hybrid vigor is an evil thought.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so verse 20. And Adam gave names to all cattle and to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field, okay, which includes two-legged animals, folks. But for Adam there was not found a helpmeet for him. Okay, so he still didn't have that great partner that he needed. Of course, every man needs a good woman, right?
Absolutely.
And so this isn't that all it's really telling us here? That Adam needed a good woman, someone really suitable for him.
Right, but it also has, I believe that the parable here, it represents a genetic
yes.
Meaning that it has to be, the only acceptable mate is somebody of your kind.
That's right. Okay. All right, verse 21. And Yahweh Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. Okay, now this one is really loaded. What is your interpretation here of verse 21?
Well, it simply shows how close that wife should be. That's what I believe. That,
okay.
That we began as a race, and we began as a pure race.
Yes.
It's not right to go out and mix with these other races, and we didn't do that.
Yes.
And despite what the evolutionists and the Jews think that mm-hmm. didn't happen.
Right, right. Well, here, I have an article entitled Adam's Rib by Wayne Simpson. Let me read a couple of paragraphs here. And it's regarding the translation of the word rib. In actuality, something far more meaningful is being expressed in this biblical account than making a new person out of a small piece of the body of another. If we look closely at the Hebrew word for rib, we will learn of something quite surprising. The word translated rib in Genesis 2 is tsela, T-S-E-L-A. This word is used in a number of other places in the Bible, and its meaning is shown to be quite different than what we have imagined. The only other place in the Bible where the English word rib occurs is in Daniel 7:5, translated from an altogether different Hebrew word. One Bible translation dares to break with the use of the traditional word rib. The Stone edition of the Chumash renders the verse this way, quote, "And he took one of his sides, and he filled in the flesh in its place." Right away you can see that what God took from Adam was a lot more than a small bone. But can this reading be justified? Let us examine other places in the Bible where this Hebrew word is used. We find that it is rendered side in a number of places. Look at Exodus 25:12. In referring to the rings of gold on the Ark of the Covenant, it says, "Two rings shall be on one side," tsilo, a variant of tsila, "and two rings on the other side." Later in verse 14, it refers to the two sides, tsilat, it's the plural form. Exodus 37:3-5 shows this same description of the ark. Okay, so he's talking, the proper translation would be side. Okay, now it's interesting, if we're talking about DNA, the male provides one side of the DNA strand, which produces a new human being, and the female provides the other side, correct?
Yeah, that's possible, but the Greek word pleura means ribs, or it could mean your side also.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is I'm defending the AV translators because that equivalency has always been
okay.
Has always been there, even though what you're saying may make sense etymologically.
Mm-hmm.
The idiom
okay.
a pleura is the other ribs and it's your side.
Yes. Okay. So we cannot take this word rib literally. It's let's presume.
Well, right. It could be any part of the side, or it could mean something with a deeper
yes.
significance. As you're pointing out, I'm not going to dispute that, but
yes.
I'm just bringing up the idiom. That's
right.
A,
yeah.
A
so because this phrase and this verse has had a lot of people scratching their heads. You know, did he literally crack a rib off of Adam, take it out of him, and then create, you know, DNA to make a woman? Or, you know, what's this really telling us? And since in verse 20 and verse 18, we're talking about a counterpart, namely helpmeet, made of the same DNA. And if we talk about ribs, let's talk about ribs for a second. It's in the bone marrow that the blood and the DNA is formed. And so a rib would be an excellent place to find DNA, okay? And so, again, we have to talk about DNA, don't we?
Absolutely, because that's the code of life. And,
right.
And
that's
the
true life.
A lot about DNA that we still don't know. And scientists, the Jews and the scientists and the evolutionists, they think they have it figured out.
Yeah.
Because they've identified 30-something thousand genes and human genes.
Yes.
But there's all this material, genetic material, besides the genes in a strand of DNA that they're dismissing as garbage.
Right,
and,
right.
And that just makes no sense at all.
Exactly. This is what I want to make important, and that's not what I want to make important, okay? By the way, your sound has faded again. If you could reestablish that good volume you had earlier, okay?
Okay.
What about this cause of deep sleep to fall upon Adam? What are we talking about here?
I can only conjecture what that means.
Okay.
I mean, I could look it up. I wasn't really
prepared
to go into that at this step.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, he could have caused him to go into a trance or a coma, let's say.
Well, right. And Yahweh has caused men to go into comas several times.
We're all in a coma.
Yeah, we're all in a coma is right. In the trances, Abraham was put into a trance.
Yes.
And Yahweh passed between the divided parts of the animals to seal the covenant. And that's what that represented then. That was a common practice in the
yes.
ancient Near East.
Okay.
And Abraham saw a vision of him passing through, but he was in a trance. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's been done before. And
right.
I don't the significance of it.
Yeah.
Well, to put man in into a state where he has to observe what's going on.
Right. Yeah.
You know, in, as such in that case, I don't know. It's hard
right.
to
Yeah, well, because this verse
make
sort of
positions about.
This verse sort of conjures up the image of someone being put under a pain-killing, narcotic that prevents him from experiencing the pain of having one of his ribs cut out. You know,
well, right? It could be like we could equate it to an operating room, but I don't know if Yahweh's the God of pharmaceuticals.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I think it's more figurative language here.
Yeah.
That requires this DNA creation process, however it took place. And, if the word tzila actually means side, it strengthens, in my opinion, the characterization of Eve as a counterpart for Adam and, not just, something made out of the same DNA. There's a real intent and motivation here that Eve should be a very important aspect of Adam's life, right?
Well, absolutely. And that is definitely stressed here in the meaning of the word counterpart, a
yes.
counterpart helper. It's more than just a wife. It's much more than just a sex toy.
Yes.
And these are the degenerative ideas that we have today. And in the ancient world, a wife was a very important part of a man's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She ran the household. She took care of all his immediate needs so that he could go out and transact business or work a farm or anything he had to do.
Right.
I mean, a woman was the queen of the house.
Right. She wasn't
as
munching chocolates and watching television.
Absolutely.
Right.
A woman is a very important part of the household
yes.
if she's performing her proper role.
Okay. Verse 22. And the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man made he a woman and brought her to the man. Okay. So in other words, whatever the DNA involved in creating Adam was certainly involved in creating the woman we know as Eve. And he made a very, very specific change, probably both to Adam and to Eve, so that they would be perfect for one another, right? Isn't that what we're being told here?
Right. But and the most important thing I get out of this entire set of verses, this entire pericope, is how close your wife should be to you genetically.
Right, right. There you go.
And that's the most important thing I see here.
Yes.
It is that when you choose a mate, she has to be of your flesh and of your bone. And,
yes.
And she has to be not your sister.
Right.
But
exactly. Yeah.
Of the same race and tribe, and that's the way it should be.
Right, and that's exactly what verse 23 means. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Now, let's take this rib business literally. If Yahweh created a woman out of the DNA of Adam's rib, what other DNA could possibly be included besides Adamite DNA?
None.
That's right. It has to be Adamite DNA.
Absolutely,
yes.
And anything else is acceptable.
Right, and so
is unacceptable.
Yes, yeah, and so the man contributes the Y chromosome, the woman contributes the X chromosomes, and that's the difference between male and female. And so we had to make some sort of distinction between male and female here, but make sure that they're perfect counterparts for one another. And I think that in general, what these verses are telling us. And we must stress DNA and the racial significance of all of that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the male, the man and woman words here are Isha and Ish.
Mm-hmm.
They're not Adam and some other word.
Oh, okay.
It's Isha and Ish here.
Okay, so male and female here. It's, Isha is woman, Ish is man. Okay.
Yes.
All right, so verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cling to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Okay? Again, stressing, one flesh. What does this mean?
Well,
does this simply mean that they're going to be living together for a while?
Well, yes, but they become one flesh in
yes.
their offspring.
Yes.
Their offspring is one flesh made from these two separate parts.
Mm-hmm. And,
and I believe that that's the connotation of the one flesh.
Right. And of course, in the later scriptures, in the New Testament, I believe it's Peter or Jude, that one of the sins of the Israelites was they went after women of strange flesh.
Absolutely.
Not of the one flesh that Adam and Eve were made of, right?
Absolutely, because you're joining that which is holy with that which was impure.
That's right. That's right. And that's what the word adultery means in its original connotation. It means to adulterate, to make impure.
Yes, it's
yes.
race mixing in the
yes.
Old Testament.
Okay, now verse 25. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. What does this naked and not ashamed connotate?
Well, I think that this is a premonition of what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
That they were naked and not ashamed because they were unfamiliar with sexual immorality.
Yes.
It can't be said that they were unfamiliar with sexual act.
Okay.
They were unfamiliar with sexual immorality.
Yes.
Once they engaged in immorality, they learned shame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is why they covered their loins.
Right.
After they ate the apple.
Exactly. The so-called apple. Right.
Yes. I'm using a metaphor. There.
Right. Yeah, well, she was the apple of your eye. Okay.
Absolutely.
It's the metaphor. Okay. All right. So here, now we're going to get into the real nitty-gritty. Genesis chapter 3. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made. So this one sentence, we must understand every aspect of what this sentence is telling us. First of all, the word serpent is translated from the Hebrew word nachash, which means whisperer, enchanter, deceiver. And the ancient Chaldean goes back, has a more specific meaning, which says to shine like brass. Okay? So this serpent had to be a very high being in order to be a whisperer, enchanter, deceiver, and to shine in such a way that Eve would take him to be something worth considering, right?
Absolutely. This wasn't a snake.
Right.
Now this serpent must be the character which is referenced at Revelations 12:9 and
right.
Revelation 22.
Okay.
That old serpent.
Yes.
Which is also the great dragon, the false accuser, the devil, the adversary, Satan.
Right.
That is this serpent. There is no room in Scripture for assuming that that old serpent of those two chapters in Revelation is anything but this serpent here in Genesis 3:1.
Right, right, yes. So
now,
we're talking, yeah, go ahead.
A lot of people try to make the claim that because the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh had made, that intones that the serpent is, it must be a snake because Yahweh made it. But that's not what this verse is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I use an example. The Ferrari is faster than any car that General Motors has made.
Yes.
Well, the Ferrari isn't made by General Motors.
Right, exactly.
The serpent's more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh made.
Yes.
Meaning that this serpent is more subtle than any of the beasts made by Yahweh in the Genesis 1 creation.
Exactly.
Exactly. Necessitate that the serpent is made in the Genesis 1 creation.
Yes. Yes.
The serpent is one of the fallen angels that were cast down here sometime during the events of the Genesis 1 creation.
Yes.
Sometime before the fall of Adam, and we discussed that when we discussed Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and we'll probably discuss it again when we discuss Genesis chapter 6.
Yes. Yeah, and then also, since the beasts of the field can refer to featherless bipeds or humanoids, then this word subtle brings it up to the human level, okay, to the level of people walking around on 2 feet.
Well, absolutely. It doesn't take much to be more subtle than a cow.
Right.
it's the living creatures of the field.
Yes.
Which Yahweh had made.
Well, let me ask you, can a snake be more subtle than a fox? Okay. Especially a Jewish fox. And, of course, this word subtle is often translated as wise, and we're talking about different kinds of wisdom. It really means deceptive.
Yes,
that's really
absolutely
what it means. Yes.
It's crafty.
Yes.
Or shrewd.
Yes.
In a good sense, it could be prudent or sensible, but it's crafty or shrewd.
Right, right. And so shrewdness is not something you would attribute to a snake.
No, but it's something I definitely attribute to a Jew.
That's right. Okay. Because what we're talking about, subtlety, and the only subtlety that literal snakes know about is laying quiet in the grass. That's about the only subtlety they know.
This is the perfect, this serpent analogy is so perfect when considering the descendants of the serpent.
That's right.
It had to be an analogy drawn by Yahweh himself.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. And when we attack Genesis 3:15, we will see that this serpent, and of course, throughout Genesis 3, in the early parts, and actually throughout most of Genesis 3, Yahweh is directly talking to this serpent, and the serpent is able to talk back. Okay, I've never seen a talking snake. So
this is definitely not a snake.
Yeah, we're obviously not talking about literal snakes, folks. And this word serpent in the Hebrew has a much broader connotation than the word snake. Okay, it doesn't say snake; it says serpent, and that's translated from the Hebrew nachash, which can be translated as literal snake, but in this phrase here, we are definitely not talking about literal snakes, okay? Now, in the second sentence of this verse, and he said to the woman, this is now the snake talking, the snake talking to Eve, okay? So you can try to picture that, folks. Now, first, let's assume it is a literal snake. And Eve's leaning up against a tree, eating her porridge and whey. And a snake crawls up and starts talking to her. Do you think she'd be sitting around talking to the snake, or would she get up and hightail it out of there?
That's the Jewish version of the creation story is written by maybe Lewis Carroll.
Yes, right. There you go. Alice in Wonderland.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. And he said to the woman, okay, now this enchanter, this whisperer, this crafty enchanter, deceiver, subtle deceiver, is saying to her, yea, has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden. Here it's put in the form of a question. And, of course, he's quoting God, he's quoting Yahweh here, as having said this to Adam. Okay? I'm not sure if he has said this to Eve directly. But, of course, Adam would certainly have instructed her.
Absolutely.
That she should not do this, okay?
And the first word out of the serpent's mouth is a lie.
Yes.
And this is the father of the people in John 8 who was a murderer and a liar from the beginning.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. Well, here he's quoting Yahweh, and he's quoting Yahweh accurately here in verse 1. Let's continue. Verse 2, and the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden or throughout the garden, God has said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest ye die. Okay, so it's apparent that Eve understood this commandment, right?
Right, and she's making a distinction between the trees.
Yes.
Between the metaphoric trees and the literal trees. And
right.
This is, I don't see this as a historic account. I see this as a parable recorded for our benefit today.
Yes.
It's a parable of what happened.
Yes. Yes.
I don't see it as a historic account, but everything right. in the parable represents something to us.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And it means race mixing. So
absolutely.
Yeah. If it is purely historical, then what we are talking about is the first instance of race mixing between an Adamite and a non-Adamite.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about, okay?
And that's why this is written.
Yes.
And, so, and this, every time we mix our race, we're expelled from the Garden of Eden.
Yes. So let me read this verse 3 again, according to the translation that I like. But of the fruit of the tree which is throughout the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Okay, so she certainly understands what that means in terms of the commandment. It's questionable whether she understands what the meaning of the word death is. So it's hard to say whether she fully comprehends the consequences of disobedience, right?
Well, right. And she's deceived by the words, so she must, her knowledge can't be represented as being complete.
Right, exactly. So before we criticize Eve too strongly, let's try to put ourselves in her place as someone who is, well, sexually naive, at least in the sense of race mixing, okay? And which a lot of our women are today, and they actually think it's good when it isn't. Verse 4, and Nahash said to the woman, you shall not surely die. Here is the lie. You shall not surely die, which directly contradicts Genesis 2:17 and directly contradicts Eve's understanding of the
right.
commandment, right?
And I don't want to go past verse 3 too fast.
Okay.
That neither shall ye touch it. That is that word touch, even though it could literally mean touch here,
yes.
it also has, like the word eat, a sexual connotation.
Yes.
Proverbs 6:29 says, so he that goeth into his neighbor's wife, whosoever toucheth her,
yes.
shall not be innocent.
Right, right.
And Ruth 2:9, have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a... That means a sexual connotation.
Right, right. Yes, yes. And we're not like Bill Clinton, who says that oral sex is not really sex.
Right.
We're not to touch. We're not even supposed to touch that which is forbidden.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, and let's take it as literal fruit. Now, there are certain such things as poisonous fruit. Okay. And we shouldn't touch that kind of poisonous fruit either, although that's a harder call in nature. We have to find out what's poisonous and what isn't. And certainly Eve could not have known that, right?
Well, not even that. There's absolutely no connotation that this tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a poisonous fruit.
Right.
There's no way that you could make something botanical out of this.
Right, right. But yes, I agree with you.
We make up stories for children.
Yes.
We tell children stories about right. snakes and apples.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, over the centuries, we have forgotten to grow up.
That's right.
And we still want to believe stories of snakes and apples.
Right. Yes.
When we're grown men and women.
Yeah. Yeah, well, here we have an instance of a word that can possibly be translated as snake, but there is certainly no word in here that can be translated as apple.
Well,
so that apple is
not,
totally
right.
that apple is totally mythological, right?
And that's the popular belief.
That's right.
You could not convince a great number of Christians that there's no apple in Genesis chapter 3.
Yeah, and there certainly is not. That word does not exist, either in the English or in the Hebrew, in Genesis chapter 3. So let me repeat verse 4, because it's extremely important, because this is the first lie recorded in Scripture. And Nahash said to the woman, "You shall not surely die." Okay, that's the first lie, folks. Keep that in mind. Genesis 3:4, verse 5. "For God does know that in the day that you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." Okay, well, we shall be as who?
Now here I would like to, well, we could cover, if you go on to read verse 6, I would like to talk about these idioms for at least a few minutes in one shot, because I'm going to go to the Epic of Gilgamesh and contemporary literature to explain these idioms.
Okay, well, let me read verse 5 again, because it's extremely important. I'll read 6 right after. "For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be open." Of course, God knows. "And you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." Now, let's take this back to verse 25, where they were naked and not ashamed of it. Continuing verse 6, "And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also to her husband with her, and he did eat." Okay, let's talk about the meaning of these two verses.
Well, okay. Moses wrote these verses about 1500 to 1450 BC. By all popular chronologies, that's the time of the Exodus,
right,
and up to the time of the conquest of Canaan by Joshua.
Yes.
And if Moses wrote these books, that's when these books had to be written.
Yes.
There's a famous poem, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was being recorded amongst the peoples of Mesopotamia,
yes,
at this same time. The earliest versions of the Epic of Gilgamesh, but they date back to perhaps 2500 BC.
Okay.
And there's solid evidence in archaeology that up to 1500 BC and even beyond that, but that early, and there's no doubt about this, that this epic was being widely distributed as literature,
mm-hmm,
amongst the people, the Semitic people, speaking people of Mesopotamia.
And that's not Jewish people, that's our people.
Right.
Yes.
The white Assyrians were Shemites. They were cousins of the Israelites, and they spoke a very similar language.
Yes.
They only recorded it in cuneiform characters instead of in Hebrew characters.
Okay.
But it was basically a very similar language to Aramaic and to Hebrew.
Okay.
Okay. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, we have a giant, actually, and Gilgamesh is actually mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls as one of the giants.
Okay.
And he rules over the Mesopotamian city of Uruk, which is the Erech mentioned at Genesis 10, verse 10 in the Bible,
mm-hmm,
Genesis 10:10. Gilgamesh is portrayed as a greedy, rapacious character and a harsh ruler who cannot be challenged.
Okay.
He has no rivals and no equals.
Yes.
Therefore, the people of the land appealed to the god Anu, one of the Assyrian gods,
mm-hmm,
for assistance.
Yes.
With this, the goddess Aruru is beckoned to create another mighty giant to compete with Gilgamesh.
Mm-hmm.
And she complies, and she creates Enkidu to be a rival to Gilgamesh.
Yes.
Enkidu is created in the wilderness of the steppe.
Uh-huh.
And the word for steppe there is Eden.
Yes.
Out of the way of civilization and any contact with humans, Enkidu becomes a great friend and a protector of wildlife.
Okay.
And he's sort of a Tarzan come Dr. Doolittle of the ancient world.
Right, right.
Well, soon Enkidu puts animal hunters and trappers in fear, and they can't make a living anymore.
Uh-huh.
Because he's protecting the animals from them.
Okay.
So, seeking relief, a hunter goes to Uruk, the city of Gilgamesh, and appeals to Gilgamesh to lend assistance against this mighty savage Enkidu.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting this from my pamphlet, Shemitic Idioms in Genesis Chapter 3, which is available on my website.
Okay.
And my primary source for this is the ancient Near Eastern texts as they relating to the Old Testament, written by, well, edited by James Pritchard of Princeton University, and it was published in 1969, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very scholarly book of Assyrian and Babylonian and Egyptian and Hittite inscriptions.
Okay.
Now, Gilgamesh, rather than leave the city to confront Enkidu, Gilgamesh advises the hunter to subdue the savage giant by quite another method. And I'm gonna read from the Epic of Gilgamesh from Tablet 1, Part 3.
Okay.
Go, my hunter, take with thee a harlot lass. When he waters the beasts at the watering place, she shall pull off her clothing, laying bare her ripeness.
Mm-hmm.
Now here's a woman's nudeness being compared to fruit.
Right.
As soon as he sees her, he will draw near to her. Reject him will his beasts that grew up on the step. The hunter does as Gilgamesh instructs him to do, and by carrying out the plot, he is quite successful.
Okay.
Now I'm going to read from part 4 of the same tablet.
Okay.
The lass freed her breasts and bared her bosom, and he possessed, meaning Enkidu, he possessed her ripeness. She was not as bashful as she welcomed his ardor. She laid aside her clothing, and he rested upon her. She treated him, the savage, to a woman's task. As his love was drawn near unto her, for 6 days and 7 nights, Enkidu comes forth, mating with the lass.
Mm-hmm.
After he had had his fill of her charms, he set his face towards his wild beasts. On seeing him, Enkidu, the gazelles ran off, and the wild beasts of the steppe drew away from his body. And what this is saying is that after he had sex with this harlot for 7 days, that the animals that loved him so much before had fled from him.
Yes.
And to continue reading, startled was Enkidu as his body became taut. His knees were motionless, for his wild beasts had gone. Enkidu had to slacken his pace. It was not as before. But now he had wisdom, broader understanding. Returning, he sits at the feet of the harlot. He looks up at the face of the harlot, his ears attentive as the harlot speaks. The harlot says to him, to Enkidu, thou art wise, and Enkidu art become like a god.
Right.
And this is a clear example that these very words that Eve states, and the serpent is supposed to state in Genesis 3, verses 4, 5, 6, 7, have to do with sexual awakening.
Yes, right.
And the Epic of Gilgamesh is concurrent Shemitic literature, which uses those same idioms to mean
right.
that same thing.
So the word wise is really exactly the opposite of what we would mean by wise today. In other words, it means an awakening, as you say, a sexual awakening, but also understanding that you have done wrong.
Because absolutely.
What other effect could this have had upon Adam that suddenly the animals that obeyed him now flee from him?
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's the fall of Adam. And that same thing is repeated. And the Assyrians are people of the same culture. They had to have these same stories handed down and expounded upon
right.
and twisted into pagan religions and all different, you know, all different kinds of happenings, because we're talking about thousands of years between the time of Adam and the time of Moses. But
yes.
they had the same religious ideas and the same stories handed down to them, and they used the same idioms, and they're clearly meaning, relating all of this to sex and to sin.
Right, right. Well, not to be overlooked is the word knowing, which has sexual connotations as well, as in knowing someone in the biblical sense, okay? To know someone in the biblical sense is to have sex with that person, okay? Verse 5, and you shall be as gods. All right, well, obviously we're talking about lesser gods. Aren't we talking about these fallen angels again?
Well, it's we are all, Scripture teaches us that all of the children of Adam are gods,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to say what that meant to Eve.
Right, right. Well, okay. Remember, this is the serpent speaking. This is Nahash speaking. Isn't he saying, you shall be like us?
Well, right. The Nahash, the
yes.
antecedents of the serpent, if not the serpent himself,
yes.
were amongst the fallen angels.
Right. Exactly.
And there's no doubt that the serpent may have very well meant that by that statement.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And so, and when we get to verse 6 then, a tree to be desired to make one wise. Now, if we're talking about a literal tree, if someone could find a tree or a fruit that would make one smarter and patent that, if I were to do that, I'd be a billionaire by now. But such a tree or such a plant or such a fruit has never been found. So obviously we're not talking about a literal tree here. We're talking about wisdom, as you say, in the sexual sense, but also in the sense of immorality. Aren't we talking about that?
Well, absolutely. It's the knowledge of sin.
Yes.
And the knowledge of sin is through experience.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Okay.
It's the consciousness of guilt.
Yes.
And we can only have consciousness of guilt and knowledge of guilt through sin.
Right. And, of course, that takes us back to Genesis 2:25, where we are told they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed.
Right. They had no consciousness of wrongdoing or error or guilt.
Yes.
Or,
yeah, or guilt.
And now they do in verse 7.
Now
in
they
Genesis
do.
7.
Yes,
and
okay.
The eyes of both of them were open.
Right. Okay, let's talk about verse 7. We'll probably conclude on that today, and we'll get to the rest of Genesis chapter 3. Let me quote it real quick. And the eyes of them were both opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Okay, so obviously these aprons did not cover their heads, did not cover their mouths, because the people who want to interpret Genesis chapter 3 as meaning it was a mental sin, that Eve had an evil thought in her mind, and that therefore she should be wearing a dunce cap, not an apron.
Absolutely.
Or if she said something wrong, she should be wearing a veil over her mouth. But these aprons cover what parts of their bodies?
Well, the Brown Drivers Briggs lexicon defines this word as a girdle, a belt, or a loin covering.
Yes.
And they covered their loins with aprons.
Right. Because that's where their shame was at, right?
They hid the scene of the crime.
That's right.
There's no doubt.
That's right. That's right. So this cannot possibly be a reference to merely a mental error or a mental sin. We're constantly, through the meanings of all these words, having double meanings in the Hebrew that refer the word touch, the word eat. And the word eat, as actually in the Hebrew, is a much broader term as well. It means to consume, to partake of, okay? So it doesn't simply mean to eat food. It has much broader connotations than that, much as I would translate it as partake of in the English, because I think that provides a proper sense, and that would be the word in English, which includes much of the Hebrew connotations as well, okay? So let me reread verse 7. And the eyes of them were both opened, and they knew that they were naked. So they had discovered shame, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves apron. And here in the margins of my Bible, it says loin covering, okay? So if the shame was located underneath their aprons, could it possibly be anything other than sexual sin?
This whole 7 verses can't be anything but sexual sin.
Right, right.
We see it in the euphemisms for all the words.
Yes.
And we see it in the contemporary literature, what they meant by to be as gods and to have that and that be wise.
Yes. Yes.
And the aprons, and everywhere you turn in these 7 verses, it's all about sex.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And then you actually have to torture the language to believe otherwise.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You have to deny 15 different euphemisms and sayings
right.
and witnesses here.
Right. So let's take it, because a lot of the anti-seedlanders will like to say, well, this is a metaphor or it's an allegory, okay? But the allegory has to have a specific meaning, right? So they like to say that the metaphor is simply for mental sin, that Eve somehow had a bad thought, and that bad thought resulted in the fall of the race. Is that conceivable, that simply having a bad thought?
No, James describes how thought leads to sin.
Right.
But the sin doesn't happen until the thought is acted on.
That's right.
There's no such thing as a thought crime in the eyes of Yahweh.
Right.
There's only a thought crime in the eyes of the Jews.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And that's evident in modern history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And certainly, as we said before, if it were simply a mental sin, the apron would be inappropriate. And what would the shame be about? You know, I mean, the anti-seedliners would have a really hard time describing, well, why loincloths? You know, what does the shame association between having an evil thought and a loincloth? There's no connection there. There's simply no connection. So they have to ignore, as we're saying right now, they have to totally ignore the sexual connotations of all these verses 1-7 and simply pretend that, you know, sex is not part of the picture, okay? But when, as we continue in reading chapter 3 to the end, we will find that indeed sexuality is being addressed here, and the specific sin is race mixing. That's we're going to continue with Genesis chapter 3 next time, ladies and gentlemen. And Bill Fink, thank you for joining me this evening. You have any final thoughts up to this point in Genesis chapter 3?
My only final thought is that the people that are against this two seed line revelation,
mm-hmm.
they defend it out of emotion.
Yes.
And not out of scholarship.
That's right.
It's all their defense is always resorts to emotional
yeah.
plea.
They spiritualize the text, don't they?
Well, when you begin to spiritualize the text, you can make it say anything you want.
That's right. That's right. You can make it say anything and nothing.
Right.
That's what they're doing.
The text has to be interpreted according to the language and the idiom.
That's right.
And witnesses have to be called in, and that's why I think that Epic of Gilgamesh is so important to this chapter. Witnesses have to be called in that are contemporary whenever they can be.
Yes, absolutely.
To show what the language means.
Right, and whatever metaphor you choose, you have to be able to back up that metaphor.
Right, you better back it up with Scripture.
You better back it up with Scripture, and there's nothing in Scripture that backs up the mental sin metaphor. I've not been able to find anything.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all.
Except that there are contortions of the words ex apatao and apatao that means seduced in Greek and that Paul uses in Corinthians of Eve.
Yes.
And they play mental gymnastics with some of those
words.
With the word
seduced, exactly.
And they ignore the part about covering the loins.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they simply have no explanation why the loincloths were necessary.
Or why pain would be in childbirth
exactly.
or several other things that are subsequent to this.
Yes, yeah, and that all relates to childbearing and sexuality, doesn't it?
Right, and the punishment with Yahweh always fits the crime.
That's right. The punishment must fit the crime.
Yes.
Exactly. But, of course, the Jews would give Adam and Eve a slap on the wrist, wouldn't they?
Well, that's because the Jewish idea of liberty is sexual perversion.
That's right. That's right.
And they're totally contrary to everything in the heart of the Saxon.
That's right. Exactly. And so, I think we have set up the rest of chapter 3 for a full discussion of the sexual nature of Genesis 1, and let's take it back to Genesis 1, kind after kind, like begets like. We're talking about reproduction. We're talking about the way species continue themselves in existence. That's what we're talking about here you cannot ignore the sexual connotation of these opening chapters of Genesis, ladies and gentlemen. You simply cannot do that. And anybody who tries is simply, how should I put it, juggling in a circus. Juggling in a circus, and they're not doing any better than that. They're certainly not interpreting Scripture according to the language that's given to us. Wouldn't you say so, Bill?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
They're interpreting Scripture according to their childhood stories about snakes and apples.
So, yeah, exactly. And they're inventing ideas and inserting ideas that simply aren't here. And you can't deal with, you can't talk about apples in Genesis because they're not there. They're simply not there. And so as we continue with Genesis chapter 3, we will try to at least get up to Genesis 4:1, which is very, very critical that we understand what's really going on when it tells us that Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And I'll read verse 2 as well. And she again bore his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. We will be able to distinguish the genetic origin of Cain and Abel, and they are not the same, ladies and gentlemen. They are not the same. So, Bill, thank you very much for being my guest again tonight.
The pleasure is mine. Praise
okay.
Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Tomorrow we'll be on with Bill and Ken Gregg on another final episode of our study in the book of Hebrews. So please join us for that. And Pastor George Udvari is going to join us toward the latter end of the show to give us his summation of the meaning of the book of Hebrews, and that should be very good as well. So thanks for listening, and please follow and recommend these broadcasts to your friends and relatives, because they need to understand that the word seed means human offspring. That's what it means. It means human offspring. It doesn't just mean a kernel that you throw in the ground. That's what we're going to be talking about next Friday night. Yahweh bless everybody.